only serving to accentuate the surrounding darkness, to make it greater and more puissant by comparison. Here, in the darkness, nothing ever changed. There was only the smothering heat and the weight of eternal darkness, and the changeless moments that could not pass because there was nothing to differentiate them one from the other. Many times, as he waited, Brookman's eyes would grow heavy and slowly close, but each time his eyes would spring open again at once, and he would find himself staring into the shadows for Wernicke. Sleep would no longer have him. It was a kingdom closed to him now. It spat him out each time he tried to enter it, just as his stomach now spat out the food he placed in it. The thought of food brought Brookman to a sharper awareness. And there in the darkness he huddled around his hunger, momentarily forgetting everything else. Never had he been so hungry. He thought of the food he had wasted earlier in the evening, and only the last few shreds of his self-control kept him from moaning aloud. Boma did moan aloud then, as though unease were contagious. As Brookman glanced at him, Boma said,
"Anya?"
in a clear, calm voice. He mumbled a little, and then, a bit more loudly, said,
"Seidel, have you set the table yet?"
And Brookman realized that Boma was no longer in the camp, that Boma was back in Dusseldorf in the tiny apartment with his fat wife and his four healthy children. And Brookman felt a pang of envy go through him for Boma, who had escaped. It was at that moment that Brookman realized that Wernicke was standing there, just beyond Boma. There had been no movement that Brookman had seen. Wernicke had seemed to slowly materialize from the darkness, atom by atom, bit by incremental bit, until at some point he had been solid enough for his presence to register on Brookman's consciousness, so that what had been only a shadow a moment before was now unmistakably Wernicke as well, however much a shadow it remained. Brookman's mouth went dry with terror, and it almost seemed that he could hear the voice of his dead grandmother whispering in his ears, boogie tales. Wernicke had said, "I'm no night spirit." Remember that he had said that. Wernicke was almost close enough to touch. He was staring down at Boma. His face, lit by a dusty shaft of light from the window, was cold and remote. Only the total lack of expression hinting at the passion that strained and quivered behind the mask. Slowly, lingeringly, Wernicke stooped over Boma.
"Anya,"
Boma said again, caressingly, and then Wernicke's mouth was on his throat. "Let him feed," said a cold, remorseless voice in Brookman's mind. "It will be easier to take him when he's nearly sated, when he's fully preoccupied and growing lethargic and logy, growing full." Slowly, with infinite caution, Brookman gathered himself to spring, watching in horror and fascination as Wernicke fed. He could hear Wernicke sucking the juice out of Boma, as if there were not enough blood in the foolish old man to satiate him, as if there were not enough blood in the whole camp, or perhaps the whole world. And now Boma was ceasing his feeble struggling, was becoming still. Brookman flung himself upon Wernicke, stabbing him twice in the back before his weight bowled them both over. There was a moment of confusion as they rolled and struggled together, all without sound, and then Brookman found himself sitting atop Wernicke, Wernicke's white face turned up to him. Brookman drove his weapon into Wernicke again, the shock of the blow jarring Brookman's arm to the shoulder. Wernicke made no outcry. His eyes were already glazing, but they looked at Brookman with recognition, with cold anger, with bitter irony, and, oddly, with what might have been resignation or relief, with what might almost have been pity. Bruckmann stabbed again and again, driving the blows home with hysterical strength, panting, rocking atop his victim, feeling Wernicke's blood spatter against his face, wrapped in the heat and steam that rose from Wernicke's torn open body like a smothering black cloud, coughing and choking on it for a moment, feeling the steam seep in through his pores and sink deep into the marrow of his bones, feeling the world seem to pulse and shimmer and change around him, as though he were suddenly seeing through new eyes, as though something had been born anew inside him. And then, abruptly, he was smelling Wernicke's blood, the hot, organic reek of it, leaning closer to drink in that sudden, overpowering smell, better than the smell of freshly baked bread, better than anything he could remember, rich and heady and strong beyond imagining. There was a moment of revulsion and horror, and he tried to wonder how long the ancient contamination had been passing from man to man to man, how far into the past the chain of lives stretched, how Wernicke himself had been trapped. And then his parched lips touched wetness, and he was drinking, drinking deeply and greedily, and his mouth was filled with the strong, clean taste of copper. The following night, after Bruckmann led the memorial prayers for Wernicke and Boma, Melnick came to him. Melnick's eyes were bright with tears.
"How can we go on without Edward? He was everything to us. What will we do now?"
"It will be all right, Moshe," Bruckmann said. "I promise you, everything will be all right."
He put his arm around Melnick for a moment to comfort him, and at the touch sensed the hot blood that pumped through the intricate network of the boy's veins, just under the skin, rich and warm and nourishing, waiting there, inviolate, for him to set it free.
Modern Masters. Necros by Brian Lumley. Brian Lumley was born in County Durham in the northeast part of England, 9 months after the death of his greatest early literary influence, H.P. Lovecraft. He joined the Corps of Royal Military Police and served for 22 years, retiring in 1980 as a warrant officer. He wrote stories while serving in the army, mainly in the style of Lovecraft, often expanding on the Cthulhu mythos, though he noted a difference between his Cthulhu and that of Lovecraft. "My guys fight back," he wrote. "Also, they like to have a laugh now and then." After he left the RMP, Lumley devoted his full time to writing. Encouraged by August Derleth, he had already produced several Lovecraftian short stories, which were published by Arkham House, then the first of his 6 Titus Crowe novels, The Burrowers Beneath, 1974, and the standalone novel Kai of Ancient Chem, 1981, followed by a series of 4 books about Lovecraft's Dreamlands milieu, then the Psychomech trilogy, 1981 to 1984. In 1984, he wrote his breakout book, Necroscope, which featured Harry Keough, the man who could talk to dead people, beginning a best-selling series that has sold more than 1 million copies. As the guest of honor at the World Horror Convention in 1998, he was given the Grand Master Award for Lifetime Achievement. Necros, not part of the Necroscope series, was first published in The Second Book of After Midnight Stories, edited by Amy Myers, London, William Kimber, 1986. The story was adapted for Ridley Scott's Showtime television series, The Hunger.
Necros by Brian Lumley, read by Robin Sachs. Part 1. An old woman in a faded blue frock and black head square paused in the shade of Mario's awning and nodded good day. She smiled a gap-toothed smile. A bulky, slouch-shouldered youth in jeans and a stained yellow T-shirt, a slope-headed idiot, probably her grandson, held her hand, drooling vacantly and fidgeting beside her. Mario nodded good-naturedly, smiled, wrapped a piece of stale focaccia in greaseproof paper, and came from behind the bar to give it to her. She clasped his hand, thanked him, turned to go. Her attention was suddenly arrested by something she saw across the road. She started, cursed vividly, harshly, and despite my meager knowledge of Italian, I picked up something of the hatred in her tone.
"Devil's spawn," she said it again. "Dog, swine."
She pointed a shaking hand and finger, said yet again, "Devil's spawn," before making the two-fingered, double-handed stabbing sign with which the Italians ward off evil. To do this, it was first necessary that she drop her salted bread, which the idiot youth at once snatched up. Then, still mouthing low, guttural imprecations, dragging the shuffling, focaccia-munching cretin behind her, she hurried off along the street and disappeared into an alley. One word that she had repeated over and over again stayed in my mind.
"Necros! Necros!"
Though the word was new to me, I took it for a curse word. The accent she had put on it had been poisonous. I sipped at my Negroni, remained seated at the small circular table beneath Mario's awning, and stared at the object of the crone's distaste. It was a motor car, a white convertible Rover, and this year's model, inching slowly forward in a stream of holiday traffic. And it was worth looking at it only for the girl behind the wheel. The little man in the floppy white hat beside her, well, he was something else too, but she was just something else. I caught just a glimpse, sufficient to feel stunned. That was good. I had thought it was something I could never know again, that feeling a man gets looking at a beautiful girl. Not after Linda. And yet, she was young, say 24 or 25, some 3 or 4 years my junior. She sat tall at the wheel, slim, raven-haired under a white, wide-brimmed summer hat, which just missed matching that of her companion, with a complexion cool and creamy enough to pore over peaches. I stood up, yes, to get a better look, and right then the traffic came to a momentary standstill. At that moment, too, she turned her head and looked at me. And if the profile had stunned me, well, the full frontal knocked me dead. The girl was simply classically beautiful. Her eyes were of a dark green, but very bright, slightly tilted, and perfectly oval under straight, thin brows. Her cheeks were high, her lips a red cupid's bow, her neck long and white against the glowing yellow of her blouse, and her smile. Oh, yes, she smiled. Her glance, at first cool, became curious in a moment, then a little angry, until finally, seeing my confusion, that smile. And as she turned her attention back to the road and followed the stream of traffic out of sight, I saw a blush of colour spreading on the creamy surface of her cheek. Then she was gone. Then, too, I remembered the little man who sat beside her. Actually, I hadn't seen a great deal of him, but what I had seen had given me the creeps. He too had turned his head to stare at me, leaving in my mind's eye an impression of beady bird eyes, sharp and intelligent in the shade of his hat. He had stared at me for only a moment, and then his head had slowly turned away. But even when he no longer looked at me, when he stared straight ahead, it seemed to me that I could feel those raven's eyes upon me, and that a query had been written in them. I believed I could understand it, that look. He must have seen a good many young men staring at him like that, or rather, at the girl. His look had been a threat in answer to my threat, and because he was practiced in it, I had certainly felt the more threatened. I turned to Mario, whose English was excellent. "She has something against expensive cars and rich people?" "Who?" He busied himself behind his bar. "The old lady, the woman with the idiot boy." "Ah," he nodded. "Mainly against the little man, I suspect." "Oh, you want another Negroni? Okay, and one for yourself. But tell me about this other thing, won't you?" "If you like. But you're only interested in the girl, yes?" He grinned. I shrugged. "She's a good looker." "Yes, I saw her." Now he shrugged. "That other thing, just old myths and legends, that's all. Like your English Dracula, eh?" "Transylvanian Dracula," I corrected him. "Whatever you like. And Necros. That's the name of the spook, see?" "Necros is the name of a vampire?" "A spook, yes." "And this is a real legend, I mean historical?" He made a 50-50 face, his hands palms up. "Local, I guess. Ligurian. I remember it from when I was a kid. If I was bad, old Necros sure to come and get me. Today," again the shrug, "it's forgotten." "Like the bogeyman," I nodded. "Eh?" "Nothing. But why did the old girl go on like that?" Again he shrugged. "Maybe she think that old man Necros, eh? She crazy, you know. Very backward. The whole family." I was still interested. "How does the legend go?" "The spook takes the life out of you. You grow old, spook grows young. It's a bargain you make. He gives you something you want, gets what he wants. What he wants is your youth, except he uses it up quick and needs more. All the time, more youth." "What kind of bargain is that?" I asked. "What does the victim get out of it?" "Gets what he wants," said Mario, his brown face cracking into another grin. "In your case, the girl, eh? If the little man was Necros." He got on with his work, and I sat there sipping my Negroni. End of conversation. I thought no more about it. Until later. Part 2. Of course, I should have been in Italy with Linda, but I had kept her dear John for a fortnight before shredding it, getting mindlessly drunk, and starting in on the process of forgetting. That had been a month ago. The holiday had already been booked, and I wasn't about to miss out on my trip to the sun. And so I had come out on my own. It was hot, the swimming was good, life was easy, and the food superb. With just 2 days left to enjoy it, I told myself it hadn't been bad. But it would have been better with Linda. Linda. She was still on my mind, at the back of it anyway. Later that night, as I sat in the bar of my hotel beside an open bougainvillea-decked balcony that looked down on the bay and the seafront lights of the town. And maybe she wasn't all that far back in my mind. Maybe she was right there in front, or else I was just plain daydreaming. Whichever, I missed the entry of the lovely lady and her shriveled companion, failing to spot and recognize them until they were taking their seats at a little table just the other side of the balcony's sweep. This was the closest I'd been to her, and, well, first impressions hadn't lied. This girl was beautiful. She didn't look quite as young as she'd first seemed. My own age, maybe, but beautiful she certainly was. And the old boy? He must be, could only be, her father. Maybe it sounds like I was a little naive, but with her looks, this lady really didn't need an old man. And if she did need one, it didn't have to be this one. By now she'd seen me, and my fascination with her must have been obvious. Seeing it, she smiled and blushed at one and the same time, and for a moment turned her eyes away, but only for a moment. Fortunately, her companion had his back to me, or he must have known my feelings at once. For as she looked at me again, fully upon me this time, I could have sworn I read an invitation in her eyes, and in that same moment, any bitter vows I may have made melted away completely and were forgotten. God, please let him be her father. For an hour I sat there, drinking a few too many cocktails, eating olives and potato crisps from little bowls on the bar, keeping my eyes off the girl as best I could, if only for common decency's sake. But all the time I worried frantically at the problem of how to introduce myself, and as the minutes ticked by, it seemed to me that the most obvious way must also be the best. But how obvious would it be to the old boy? And the damnable thing was that the girl hadn't given me another glance since her original invitation. Had I mistaken that look of hers? Or was she simply waiting for me to make the first move? God let him be her father. She was sipping martinis slowly. He drank a rich red wine, in some quantity. I asked a waiter to replenish their glasses and charge it to me. I had already spoken to the bar steward, a swarthy, friendly little chap from the south called Francesco, but he hadn't been able to enlighten me. The pair were not resident, he assured me, but being resident myself, I was already pretty sure of that. Anyway, my drinks were delivered to their table. They looked surprised. The girl put on a perfectly innocent expression, questioned the waiter, nodded in my direction, and gave me a cautious smile, and the old boy turned his head to stare at me. I found myself smiling in return, but avoiding his eyes, which were like coals now, sunken deep in his brown, wrinkled face. Time seemed suspended, if only for a second. Then the girl spoke again to the waiter, and he came across to me. "Mr. Collins, sir, the gentleman and the young lady thank you and request that you join them." Which was everything I had dared hope for the moment. Standing up, I suddenly realized how much I'd had to drink. I willed sobriety on myself and walked across to their table. They didn't stand up, but the little chap said, "Please sit." His voice was a rustle of dried grass. The waiter was behind me with a chair. I sat. "Peter Collins," I said. "How do you do, Mr.
Karpethis," he answered. "Nikos Karpethis. And this is my wife, Adrienne."
Neither one of them had made the effort to extend their hands, but that didn't dismay me. Only the fact that they were married dismayed me. He must be very, very rich, this Nikos Karpethis. "I'm delighted you invited me over," I said, forcing a smile. "But I see that I was mistaken. You see, I thought I heard you speaking English, and I..."
"Thought we were English," she finished it for me. "A natural error. Originally, I am Armenian. Nikos is Greek, of course. We do not speak each other's tongue, but we do both speak English. Are you staying here, Mr. Collins?"
Yes, for one more day and night. Then," I shrugged and put on a sad look, "back to England, I'm afraid."
"Afraid?" the old boy whispered. "There is something to fear in a return to your homeland?"
"Just an expression," I answered. "I meant I'm afraid that my holiday is coming to an end." He smiled. It was a strange, wistful sort of smile, wrinkling his face up like a little walnut.
"But your friends will be glad to see you again, your loved ones."
I shook my head. "Only a handful of friends, none of them really close, and no loved ones. I'm a loner, Mr. Karpethis."
"A loner?"
His eyes glowed deep in their sockets, and his hands began to tremble where they gripped the table's rim.
"Mr. Collins, you don't... We understand, she cut him off, for although we are together, we two in our way are loners. Money has made Nikos lonely, you see. Also, he is not a well man, and time is short. He will not waste what time he has on frivolous friendships. As for myself, people do not understand our being together, Nikos and I. They pry, and I withdraw. And so I, too, am a loner. There was no accusation in her voice, but still I felt obliged to say, I certainly didn't intend to pry, Mrs. Adrienne, she smiled. Please. No, of course you didn't. I would not want you to think we thought that of you. Anyway, I will tell you why we are together, and then it will be put aside. Her husband coughed, seemed to choke, struggled to his feet. I stood up and took his arm. He at once shook me off with some distaste, I thought, but Adrienne had already signaled to a waiter. Assist Mr. Carpethes to the gentleman's room, she quickly instructed in very good Italian, and please help him back to the table when he has recovered. As he went, Carpethes gesticulated, probably tried to say something to me by way of an apology, choked again, and reeled as he allowed the waiter to help him from the room. I'm sorry, I said, not knowing what else to say. He has attacks. She was cool. Do not concern yourself. I am used to it. We sat in silence for a moment. Finally, I began, you were going to tell me... Ah, yes, I had forgotten. It is a symbiosis. Oh? Yes. I need the good life he can give me, and he needs my youth. We supply each other's needs. And so, in a way, the old woman with the idiot boy hadn't been wrong after all. A sort of bargain had indeed been struck between Carpethes and his wife. As that thought crossed my mind, I felt the short hairs at the back of my neck stiffen for a moment. Goose flesh crawled on my arms. After all, Nikos was pretty close to Nekros, and now this youth thing again. Coincidence, of course, and after all, aren't all relationships bargains of sorts? Bargains struck for better or for worse. But for how long? I asked. I mean, how long will it work for you? She shrugged. I have been provided for, and he will have me all the days of his life. I coughed, cleared my throat, gave a strained, self-conscious laugh. And here's me, the non-prior. No, not at all. I wanted you to know. Well, I shrugged, but it's been a pretty deep first conversation. First, did you believe that buying me a drink would entitle you to more than one conversation? I almost winced. Actually, I... But then she smiled and my world lit up. You did not need to buy the drinks, she said. There would have been some other way. I looked at her inquiringly. Some other way to find out if we were English or not? Oh. Here comes Nikos now. She smiled across the room. And we must be leaving. He's not well. Tell me, will you be on the beach tomorrow? Oh. Yes, I answered after a moment's hesitation. I like to swim. So do I. Perhaps we can swim out to the raft. I'd like that very much. Her husband arrived back at the table under his own steam. He looked a little stronger now, not quite so shriveled somehow. He did not sit, but gripped the back of his chair with parchment fingers, knuckles white where the skin stretched over old bones.
Is there Collins? He rustled. Adrienne, I'm sorry.
There's really no need,
I said, rising.
We really must be going.
She also stood.
No, you stay here, Peter. It's kind of you, but we can manage. Perhaps we'll see you on the beach.
And she helped him to the door of the bar and through it, without once looking back. Part 3. They weren't staying at my hotel, had simply dropped in for a drink. That was understandable, though I would have preferred to think that she had been looking for me, for my hotel was middling tourist class, while theirs was something else. They were up on the hill, high on the crest of a Ligurian spur, where a smaller, much more exclusive place nested in Mediterranean pines. A place whose lights spelled money when they shone up there at night, whose music came floating down from a tiny open-air disco like the laughter of high-living elementals of the air. If I was poetic, it was because of her. I mean, that beautiful girl and that weary, wrinkled, dried-up walnut of an old man. If anything, I was sorry for him. And yet, in another way, I wasn't. And let's make no pretense about it. If I haven't said it already, let me say it right now. I wanted her. Moreover, there had been that about our conversation, her beach invitation, which told me that she was available. The thought of it kept me awake half the night. I was on the beach at 9 a.m. They didn't show until 11. When they did, and when she came out of her tiny changing cubicle, there wasn't a male head on the beach that didn't turn at least twice. Who could blame them? That girl in that costume would have turned the head of a sphinx. But there was something, some little nagging thing different about her. A maturity beyond her years. She held herself like a model, a princess. But who was it for? Carpetes or me? As for the old man, he was in a crumpled, lightweight summer suit and sunshade hat, as usual, but he seemed a bit more perky this morning. Unlike myself, he'd doubtless had a good night's sleep. While his wife had been changing, he had made his way unsteadily across the pebbly beach to my table and sun umbrella, taking the seat directly opposite me. And before his wife could appear, he had opened with, "Good morning, Mr. Collins." "Good morning," I answered. "Please call me Peter."
"Peter, then," he nodded.
He seemed out of breath, either from his stumbling walk over the beach or a certain urgency which I could detect in his movements, his hurried, almost rude, "let's get down to it" manner.
"Peter, you said you would be here for one more day."
"That's right," I answered, for the first time studying him closely where he sat like some strange garden gnome, half in the shade of the beach umbrella. "This is my last day." He was a bundle of dry wood, a pallid prune, a small umber scarecrow. And his voice, too, was of straw or autumn leaves blown across a shady path. Only his eyes were alive.
"And you say that you have no family, few friends, no one to miss you back in England?"
Warning bells rang in my head. Maybe it wasn't so much urgency in him, which usually implies a goal or ambition still to be realized, but eagerness in that the goal was in sight. "That's correct. I am, was, a student doctor. When I get home, I shall seek a position. Other than that, there's nothing, no one, no ties." He leaned forward, bird eyes very bright, claw hand reaching across the table, trembling, and her shadow suddenly fell across us as she stood there in that costume. Carpetes jerked back in his chair. His face was working, strange emotions twisting the folds and wrinkles of his flesh into stranger contours. I could feel my heart thumping against my ribs. Why, I couldn't say. I calmed myself, looked up at her, and smiled. She stood with her back to the sun, which made a dark silhouette of her head and face. But in that blot of darkness, her oval eyes were green jewels.
"Shall we swim, Peter?"
She turned and ran down to the beach, and of course I ran after her. She had a head start and beat me to the water, beat me to the raft, too. It wasn't until I hauled myself up beside her that I thought of Carpathis. How I hadn't even excused myself before plunging after her. But at least the water had cleared my head, bringing me completely awake and aware. Aware of her incredible body, where it stretched, almost touching mine, on the fiber deck of the gently bobbing raft. I mentioned her husband's line of inquiry, gasping a little for breath as I recovered from the frantic exercise of our race. She, on the other hand, already seemed completely recovered. She carefully arranged her hair about her shoulders like a fan to dry in the sunlight before answering.
"Nikos is not really my husband," she finally said, not looking at me. "I am his companion. That's all. I could have told you last night, but there was the chance that you really were curious only about our nationality. As for any veiled threats he might have issued, that is not unusual. He might not have the vitality of younger men, but jealousy is ageless."
"No," I answered, "he didn't threaten. Not that I noticed. But jealousy. Knowing I have only one more day to spend here, what is he to fear from me?" Her shoulders twitched a little. A shrug. She turned her face to me, her lips inches away. Her eyelashes were like silken shutters over green pools, hiding whatever swam in the deeps.
"I am young, Peter, and so are you. And you are very attractive, very eager. Holiday romances are not uncommon."
My blood was on fire. "I have very little money," I said. "We are staying at different hotels. He already suspects me. It is impossible."
"What is?"
she innocently asked, leaving me at a complete loss. But then she laughed, tossed back her hair already dry, dangled her hands and arms in the water.
"Where there's a will," she said.
"You know that I want you," the words spilled out before I could control or change them.
"Oh, yes, and I want you."
She said it so simply, and yet suddenly I felt seared, a moth brushing the magnet candle's flame. I lifted my head, looked toward the beach. Across 75 yards of sparkling water, the beach umbrellas looked very large and close. Carpathis sat in the shade, just as I had last seen him, his face hidden in shadow, but I knew that he watched.
"You can do nothing here," she said, her voice languid, but I noticed now that she too seemed short of breath.
"This," I told her with a groan, "is going to kill me." She laughed. Laughter that sparkled more than the sun on the sea.
"I'm sorry," she sobered. "It's unfair of me to laugh. But your case is not hopeless."
"Oh?"
"Tomorrow morning, early, Nikos has an appointment with a specialist in Genova. I am to drive him into the city tonight. We'll stay at the hotel overnight."
I groaned my misery. "Then my case is quite hopeless. I fly tomorrow."
"But if I sprained my wrist," she said, "and so could not drive, and if he went into Genova by taxi while I stayed behind with a headache, because of the pain from my wrist,
Like a flash, she was on her feet, the raft tilting, her body diving, striking the water into a spray of diamonds. Seconds for it all to sink in, and then I was following her, laboring through the water in her churning wake. And as she splashed from the sea, seeing her stumble go to her hands and knees in Ligurian shingle, and the pained look on her face, the way she held her wrist as she came to her feet. As easy as that. Carpetes, struggling to rise from his seat, stared at her with his mouth agape. Her face screwed up now as I followed her up the beach, and Adrienne holding her sprained wrist and shaking it, her mouth forming an elongated O. The sinuous motion of her body and limbs, mobile marble with dew of ocean, clinging saltily. If the tiny man had said to me, "I am Necros, I want 10 years of your life for one night with her," at that moment, I might have sealed the bargain. Gladly. But legends are legends, and he wasn't Necros, and he didn't, and I didn't. After all, there was no need. Part 4. I suppose my greatest fear was that she might be having me on, amusing herself at my expense. She was, of course, safe with me, insofar as I would be gone tomorrow, and the romance forgotten, for her anyway, and I could also see how she was starved for young companionship, a fact she had brought right out in the open from the word go. But why me? Why should I be so lucky? Attractive? Was I? I had never thought so. Perhaps it was because I was so safe, here today and gone tomorrow, with little or no chance of complications. Yes, that must be it. If she wasn't simply making a fool of me, she might just be a tease. But she wasn't. At 8:30 that evening, I was in the bar of my hotel. Had been there for an hour, careful not to drink too much, unable to eat, when the waiter came to me and said there was a call for me on the reception telephone. I hurried out to reception, where the clerk discreetly excused himself and left me alone. "Peter," her voice was a deep well of promise. "He's gone. I've booked us a table to dine at 9. Is that all right for you?" "A table? Where?" My own voice, breathless. "Why, up here, of course. Oh, don't worry, it's perfectly safe. And anyway, Nikos knows." "Knows?" I was taken aback, a little panicked. "What does he know?" "That we're dining together. In fact, he suggested it. He didn't want me to eat alone, and since this is your last night..." "I'll get a taxi right away," I told her. "Good. I look forward to seeing you. I shall be in the bar." I replaced the telephone in its cradle, wondering if she always took an aperitif before the main course. I had smartened myself up. That is to say, I was immaculate. Black bow tie, white evening jacket, courtesy of C&A, black trousers, and a lightly frilled white shirt, the only one I had ever owned. But I might have known that my appearance would never match up to hers. It seemed that everything she did was just perfectly right. I could only hope that that meant literally everything. But in her black lace evening gown with its plunging neckline, short, wide sleeves, and delicate silver embroidery, she was stunning. Sitting with her in the bar, sipping our drinks, for me a large whiskey, and for her a tall Cinzano, I couldn't take my eyes off her. Twice I reached out for her hand, and twice she drew back from me. "Discreet they may well be," she said, letting her oval green eyes flicker toward the bar, where guests stood and chatted, and back to me.
but there's really no need to give them occasion to gossip.
I'm sorry, Adrienne, I told her, my voice husky and close to trembling, but
how is it, she demurely cut me off, that a good-looking man like you is, how do you say it, going short?
I sat back, chuckled. That's a rather unladylike expression, I told her.
Oh? And what I've planned for tonight is ladylike?
My voice went huskier still. Just what is your plan?
While we eat, she answered, her voice low, I shall tell you.
At which point a waiter loomed, towel over his arm, inviting us to accompany him to the dining room. Adrienne's portions were tiny, mine huge. She sipped a slender, light white wine. I gulped blocky, rich red from a glass the waiter couldn't seem to leave alone. Mercifully, I was hungry. I hadn't eaten all day, else that meal must surely have bloated me out. And all of it ordered in advance, the very best in quality cuisine.
This, she eventually said, handing me her key, fits the door of our suite.
We were sitting back, enjoying liqueurs and cigarettes.
The rooms are on the ground floor. Tonight you enter through the door. Tomorrow morning you leave via the window. A slow walk down the seafront will refresh you. How is that for a plan?
Unbelievable.
You don't believe it?
Not my good fortune, no.
Shall we say that we both have our needs?
I think, I said, that I may be falling in love with you. What if I don't wish to leave in the morning? She shrugged, smiled, said,
Who knows what tomorrow may bring?
How could I ever have thought of her simply as another girl, or even an ordinary young woman? Girl she certainly was, woman too, but so, knowing, beautiful as a princess and knowing as a whore. If Mario's old myths and legends were reality, and if Nikos Karpethis were really Nekros, then he'd surely picked the right companion. No man born could ever have resisted Adrienne, of that I was quite certain. These thoughts were in my mind, but dimly, at the back of my mind, as I left her smoking in the dining room and followed her directions to the suite of rooms at the rear of the hotel. In the front of my mind were other thoughts, much more vivid and completely erotic. I found the suite, entered, left the door slightly ajar behind me. The thing about an Italian room is its size. An entire suite of rooms is vast. As it happened, I was only interested in one room, and Adrienne had obligingly left the door to that one open. I was sweating, and yet I shivered. Adrienne had said 15 minutes, time enough for her to smoke another cigarette and finish her drink. Then she would come to me. By now the entire staff of the hotel probably knew I was in here, but this was Italy. Part 5. I shivered again. Excitement? Probably. I threw off my clothes, found my way to the bathroom, took the quickest shower of my life. Drying myself off, I padded back to the bedroom. Between the main bedroom and the bathroom, a smaller door stood ajar. I froze as I reached it, my senses suddenly alert, my ears seeming to stretch themselves into vast receivers to pick up any slightest sound. For there had been a sound, I was sure of it, from that room. A scratching, a rustle,
A whisper? I couldn't say, but a sound, anyway. Adrienne would be coming soon. Standing outside that door, I slowly recommenced toweling myself dry. My naked feet were still firmly rooted, but my hands automatically worked with the towel. It was nerves, only nerves. There had been no sound, or at worst only the night breeze off the sea, whispering in through an open window. I stopped toweling, took another step toward the main bedroom, heard the sound again, a small, choking rasp, a tiny gasping for air. Carpetes. What the hell was going on? I shivered violently, my suddenly chill flesh shuddering in an uncontrollable spasm. But I forced myself to action, returned to the main bedroom, quickly dressed with the exceptions of my tie and jacket, and crept back to the small room. Adrienne must be on her way to me even now. She mustn't find me poking my nose into things like a suspicious kid. I must kill off this silly feeling that had my skin crawling. Not that an attack of nerves was unnatural in the circumstances, on the contrary, but I wasn't about to let it spoil the night. I pushed open the door of the room, entered into darkness, found the light switch, then I held my breath, flipped the switch. The room was only half as big as the others. It contained a small single bed, a bedside table, a wardrobe. Nothing more, or at least nothing immediately apparent to my wildly darting eyes. My heart, which was racing, slowed and began to settle toward a steadier beat. The window was open, external shutters closed, but small night sounds were finding their way in through the louvers. The distant sounds of traffic, the toot of horns, holiday sounds from below. I breathed deeply and gratefully, and saw something projecting from beneath the pillow on the bed, a corner of card or of dark leather, like a wallet or a passport. A Greek passport. Carpetes. When I opened it. But how could it be? The man in the photograph was young, no older than me. His birth date proved it, and there was his name, Nikos Carpetes, printed in Greek, of course, but still plain enough. His son? Puzzling over the passport had served to distract me. My nerves had steadied up. I tossed the passport down, frowned at it where it lay upon the bed, breathed deeply once more, and froze, solid. A scratching, a hissing, a dry grunting from the wardrobe. Mice? Or did I in fact smell a rat? Even as the short hairs bristled on the back of my neck, I knew anger. There were too many unexplained things here, too much I didn't understand. And what was it I feared? Old Mario's myths and legends? No. For in my experience, the Italians are notorious for getting things wrong. Oh yes, notorious. I reached out, turned the wardrobe's doorknob, yanked the doors open. At first I saw nothing of any importance or significance. My eyes didn't know what they sought. Shoes, patent leather, two pairs stood side by side below. Tiny suits, no bigger than boys' sizes, hung above on steel hangers. And, my God, a waistcoat. I backed out of that little room on rubber legs, with the silence of the sweet shrieking all about me, my eyes bugging, my jaw hanging slack. Peter? She came in through the suite's main door, came floating toward me, eager, smiling, her green eyes blazing. Then blazing their suspicion, their anger, as they saw my condition. Peter. I lurched away as her hands reached for me, those hands I had never yet touched, which had never touched me. Then I was into the main bedroom, snatching my tie and jacket from the bed, don't ask me why, and out of the window, yelling some inarticulate choking thing at her and lashing out frenziedly with my foot as she reached after me. Her eyes were bubbling green hells.
Peter?
Her fingers closed on my forearm, bands of steel containing a fierce, hungry heat. And strong as two men, she began to lift me back into her lair. I put my feet against the wall, kicked, came free, and crashed backward into shrubbery. Then up on my feet, gasping for air, running, tumbling, crashing into the night, down madly tilting slopes, through black chasms of mountain pine, with the Mediterranean stars winking overhead, and the beckoning, friendly lights of the village seen occasionally below. In the morning, looking up at the way I had descended and remembering the nightmare of my panic flight, I counted myself lucky to have survived it. The place was precipitous. In the end, I had fallen, but only for a short distance, all in utter darkness and my head striking something hard, but I did survive. Survived both Adrienne and my flight from her. And waking with the dawn, and gently fingering my bruises and the massive bump on my forehead, I made my staggering way back to my still slumbering hotel, let myself in, and locked myself in my room, then sat there trembling and moaning until it was time for the coach. Weak? Maybe I was. Maybe I am. But on my way into Geneva, with people round me and the sun hot through the coach's windows, I could think again. I could roll up my sleeve and examine that claw mark of four slim fingers and a thumb, branded white into my suntanned flesh, where hair would never more grow, on skin sere and wrinkled. And seeing those marks, I could also remember the wardrobe and the waistcoat, and what the waistcoat contained. That tiny puppet of a man, alive still but barely, his stick arms dangling through the waistcoat's armholes, his baby's head projecting, its chin supported by the tightly buttoned waistcoat's breast, and the large bulldog clip over the hanger's bar, its teeth fastened in the loose, wrinkled skin of his walnut head, holding it up, and his skinny little legs dangling, twig things twitching there, and his pleading, pleading eyes. But eyes are something I mustn't dwell upon, and green is a color I can no longer bear.
The Man Upstairs by Ray Bradbury. Ray Douglas Bradbury, born in 1920, was born in Waukegan, Illinois, and moved to California as a young boy, graduating from Los Angeles High School and, eschewing college, got his first job as a newsboy. He sold his first short story to a pulp magazine, Super Science Stories, in 1941, and became a full-time writer the following year. His first book was a collection, Dark Carnival, 1947. He has since produced more than 600 stories and 60 books, including such modern classics as The Martian Chronicles, 1950, The Illustrated Man, 1951, Fahrenheit 451, 1953, The October Country, 1955, Dandelion Wine, 1957, and I Sing the Body Electric, 1969. Many of his works have been filmed for television, most notably the 65 stories that he adapted for the Ray Bradbury Theater and the three-part miniseries The Martian Chronicles, which starred Rock Hudson in 1980. Films based on his novels include It Came from Outer Space, 1953, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, 1953, The Illustrated Man, 1969, and the excellent Fahrenheit 451, 1966, which starred Oscar Werner and Julie Christie. He has won too many awards to count, including a special Pulitzer citation, a star on Hollywood Boulevard's Hollywood Walk of Fame, the Bram Stoker Award, the World Fantasy and SFWA Lifetime Achievement Awards, and the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. The Man Upstairs was originally published in the March 1947 issue of Harper's Magazine.
The Man Upstairs by Ray Bradbury. Read by Mark Cashman. He remembered how carefully and expertly Grandmother would fondle the cold-cut guts of the chicken and withdraw the marvels therein. The wet, shining loops of meat-smelling intestine, the muscled lump of heart, the gizzard with the collection of seeds in it. How neatly and nicely Grandma would slit the chicken and push her fat little hand in to deprive it of its metals. These would be segregated, some in pans of water, others in paper to be thrown to the dog later, perhaps. And then, the ritual of taxidermy, stuffing the bird with watered, seasoned bread, and performing surgery with a swift, bright needle, stitch after pull-tight stitch. This was one of the prime thrills of Douglas's 11-year-old lifespan. Altogether, he counted 20 knives in the various squeaking drawers of the magic kitchen table from which Grandma, a kindly, gentle-faced, white-haired old witch, drew paraphernalia for her miracles. Douglas was to be quiet. He could stand across the table from Grandma, his freckled nose tucked over the edge, watching, but any loose boy talk might interfere with the spell. It was a wonder when Grandma brandished silver shakers over the bird, supposedly sprinkling showers of mummy dust and pulverized Indian bones, muttering mystical verses under her toothless breath. "Grammy," said Douglas at last, breaking the silence, "am I like that inside?" He pointed at the chicken. "Yes," said Grandma, "a little more orderly and presentable, but just about the same." "And more of it," added Douglas, proud of his guts. "Yes," said Grandma, "more of it. Grandpa has lots more in me. He sticks out in front so he can rest his elbows on it." Grandma laughed and shook her head. Douglas said, "And Lucy Williams down the street, she..." "Hush, child," cried Grandma. "But she's got..." "Never you mind what she's got. That's different." "But why is she different?" "A darning needle dragonfly is coming by some day and sew up your mouth," said Grandma firmly. Douglas waited, then asked, "How do you know I've got insides like that, Grandma?" "Oh, go away now." The front doorbell rang. Through the front door glass, as he ran down the hall, Douglas saw a straw hat. The bell jangled again and again. Douglas opened the door. "Good morning, child. Is the landlady at home?" Cold gray eyes in a long, smooth, walnut-colored face gazed upon Douglas. The man was tall, thin, and carried a suitcase, a briefcase, an umbrella under one bent arm, gloves rich and thick and gray on his thin fingers, and wore a horribly new straw hat. Douglas backed up. "She's busy." "I wish to rent her upstairs room, as advertised." "We've got 10 boarders, and it's already rented. Go away." "Douglas!" Grandma was behind him suddenly. "How do you do?" she said to the stranger. "Never mind this child." Unsmiling, the man stepped stiffly in. Douglas watched them ascend out of sight up the stairs, heard Grandma detailing the conveniences of the upstairs room. Soon, she hurried down to pile linens from the linen closet on Douglas and send him scooting up with them. Douglas paused at the room's threshold. The room was changed, oddly, simply because the stranger had been in it a moment. The straw hat lay brittle and terrible upon the bed. the umbrella leaned stiff against one wall, like a dead bat with dark wings folded. Douglas blinked at the umbrella. The stranger stood in the center of the changed room, tall, tall. Here. Douglas littered the bed with supplies. We eat at noon sharp, and if you're late coming down, the soup will get cold. Grandma fixes it so it will, every time. The tall, strange man counted out 10 new copper pennies and tinkled them in Douglas's blouse pocket. We shall be friends, he said grimly. It was funny, the man having nothing but pennies. Lots of them. No silver at all, no dimes, no quarters. Just new copper pennies. Douglas thanked him glumly. I'll drop these in my dime bank when I get them changed into a dime. I got $6.50 in dimes all ready for my camp trip in August. I must wash now, said the tall, strange man. Once, at midnight, Douglas had awakened to hear a storm rumbling outside. The cold, hard wind shaking the house, the rain driving against the window. And then, a lightning bolt had landed outside the window with a silent, terrific concussion. He remembered that fear of looking about at his room, seeing it strange and awful in the instantaneous light. So it was, now, in this room. He stood looking up at the stranger. This room was no longer the same, but changed indefinably, because this man, quick as a lightning bolt, had shed his light about it. Douglas backed up slowly as the stranger advanced. The door closed in his face. The wooden fork went up with mashed potatoes, came down empty. Mr. Koberman, for that was his name, had brought the wooden fork and wooden knife and spoon with him when Grandma called lunch. Mrs. Spaulding, he said quietly, my own cutlery. Please use it. I will have lunch today, but from tomorrow on, only breakfast and supper. Grandma bustled in and out, bearing steaming tureens of soup and beans and mashed potatoes to impress her new boarder, while Douglas sat rattling his silverware on his plate, because he had discovered it irritated Mr. Koberman. I know a trick, said Douglas. Watch. He picked a fork tine with his fingernail. He pointed at various sectors of the table, like a magician. Wherever he pointed, the sound of the vibrating fork tine emerged, like a metal elfin voice. Simply done, of course. He pressed the fork handle on the tabletop, secretly. The vibration came from the wood like a sounding board. It looked quite magical. There, there, and there, exclaimed Douglas, happily plucking the fork again. He pointed at Mr. Koberman's soup, and the noise came from it. Mr. Koberman's walnut-colored face became hard and firm and awful. He pushed the soup bowl away violently, his lips twisting. He fell back in his chair. Grandma appeared. Why, what's wrong, Mr. Koberman?
I cannot eat the soup.
Why?
Because I am full and can eat no more. Thank you.
Mr. Koberman left the room, glaring. What did you do just then? Asked Grandma Douglas sharply. Nothing. Grandma, why does he eat with wooden spoons? Yours not to question. When do you go back to school anyway? 7 weeks. Oh, my Lord, said Grandma. Mr. Koberman worked nights. Each morning at 8, he arrived mysteriously home, devoured a very small breakfast, and then slept soundlessly in his room all through the dreaming hot daytime until the huge supper with all the other boarders at night. Mr. Koberman's sleeping habits made it necessary for Douglas to be quiet. This was unbearable. So, whenever Grandma visited down the street. Douglas stomped up and down stairs, beating a drum, bouncing golf balls, or just screaming for 3 minutes outside Mr. Coberman's door, or flushing the toilet 7 times in succession. Mr. Coberman never moved. His room was silent, dark. He did not complain. There was no sound. He slept on and on. It was very strange. Douglas felt a pure white flame of hatred burn inside himself with a steady, unflickering beauty. Now that room was Coberman land. Once it had been flowery bright when Miss Sadlow lived there. Now it was stark, bare, cold, clean, everything in its place, alien and brittle. Douglas climbed upstairs on the 4th morning. Halfway to the 2nd floor was a large, sun-filled window, framed by 6-inch panes of orange, purple, blue, red, and burgundy glass. In the enchanted early mornings, when the sun fell through to strike the landing and slide down the stair banister, Douglas stood entranced at this window, peering at the world through the multicolored panes. Now a blue world, a blue sky, blue people, blue streetcars, and blue trotting dogs. He shifted panes. Now, an amber world. 2 lemonish women glided by, resembling the daughters of Fu Manchu. Douglas giggled. This pane made even the sunlight more purely golden. It was 8 a.m. Mr. Coberman strolled by below, on the sidewalk, returning from his night's work, his umbrella looped over his elbow, straw hat glued to his head with patent oil. Douglas shifted panes again. Mr. Coberman was a red man walking through a red world with red trees and red flowers and something else. Something about Mr. Coberman. Douglas squinted. The red glass did things to Mr. Coberman. His face, his suit, his hands. The clothes seemed to melt away. Douglas almost believed, for one terrible instant, that he could see inside Mr. Coberman. And what he saw made him lean wildly against the small red pane, blinking. Mr. Coberman glanced up just then, saw Douglas, and raised his umbrella angrily, as if to strike. He ran swiftly across the red lawn to the front door. "Young man," he cried, running up the stairs, "what were you doing?"
"Just looking," said Douglas, numbly.
"That's all, is it?" cried Mr. Coberman.
"Yes, sir. I looked through all the glasses. All kinds of worlds. Blue ones, red ones, yellow ones, all different."
"All kinds of worlds, is it?"
Mr. Coberman glanced at the little panes of glass, his face pale. He got hold of himself. He wiped his face with a handkerchief and pretended to laugh.
"Yes, all kinds of worlds, all different."
He walked to the door of his room.
"Go right ahead, play," he said.
The door closed. The hall was empty. Mr. Coberman had gone in. Douglas shrugged and found a new pane. "Oh, everything's violet." Half an hour later, while playing in his sandbox behind the house, Douglas heard the crash and the shattering tinkle. He leaped up. A moment later, Grandma appeared on the back porch, the old razor strop trembling in her hand.
"Douglas, I told you time and again never fling your basketball against the house. Oh, I could just cry."
"I've been sitting right here," he protested.
"Come see what you've done, you nasty boy."
The great colored window panes lay shattered in a rainbow chaos on the upstairs landing. His basketball lay in the ruins.
Before he could even begin telling his innocence, Douglas was struck with a dozen stinging blows upon his rump. Wherever he landed, screaming, the razor strop struck again. Later, hiding his mind in the sand pile like an ostrich, Douglas nursed his dreadful pains. He knew who'd thrown that basketball. A man with a straw hat and a stiff umbrella and a cold gray room. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He dribbled tears. Just wait. Just wait. He heard Grandma sweeping up the broken glass. She brought it out and threw it in the trash bin. Blue, pink, yellow meteors of glass dropped brightly down. When she was gone, Douglas dragged himself, whimpering, over to save out three pieces of the incredible glass. Mr. Koberman disliked the colored windows. These, he clinked them in his fingers, would be worth saving.